LUCZEWSKI 14634 for Lou Sebald, the defendant appellant. This is Lou Sebald's appeal from an adverse decision in an indirect punitive contempt proceeding. Sebald wins on the briefs, and he would like to reserve as much time as possible for rebuttal. Does the court have any questions? Well, if not, there's one thing that I need to correct about the reply brief. It's on page 18 under the heading, "This Court Should Not Expand Kaiser Beyond Nominal Bonds." About 6 lines up from the bottom of that, the actual sentence reads, "This Court should expand." It should read "should not." That's the argument, is it should not expand. So that's just I don't know if it's a typographical error or editorial error I noticed when I was going through the reply brief today in preparation. If that change would be noted, I would appreciate it, because I don't want you thinking I'm arguing for the expansion, even though I think the brief makes that clear.
Counsel, I do have a question to ask you about the attorney CC. Bishop Plumbing said that with regard to the attorney's fees that you did not ask for a hearing in the district court. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Counsel, I also have a question about Kaiser. Was Kaiser's holding limited to the fact that it was a nominal bond?
That's the way I read Kaiser. It was limited to the facts of that case, whether it's a nominal bond, therefore it didn't matter. And the other mistake about Kaiser, relying on Kaiser for anything, is that it went outside of Colorado for sister state authority or foreign authority when it didn't have to, because there was already a Colorado Supreme Court case, Stull. I mentioned that in the brief that addressed this issue. So it would be a mistake to find that Kaiser means that it doesn't matter about any bond, let alone a nominal bond. I don't know, because we don't have a nominal bond here. I can't say you should do anything about Kaiser. You just don't expand it beyond nominal bonds.
Counsel, I have one more question. With regard to your argument that you didn't believe that Bishop Plumbing's counsel should prosecute the contempt proceeding.
Yes.
Were you challenging the statute, or not the statute, but Rule 107D in all cases, or just in this case where
Sebald's previous counsel objected and said, you know, he needs a disinterested prosecutor to get a fair trial. That's what the argument that I did present was, may appoint sometimes means shall appoint. I recognize that, but we're limited to the situation that we have, and I can't ask this court based on the situation to say that it means always, because we have a situation where counsel objected and said, you can't let this guy prosecute this appeal, and actually objected to it on the grounds that Sebald would not get a fair trial because of it. And the court has to limit its findings to the case.
Right, I understand that, but I didn't understand then from your brief or from all of the briefs that whether there was any situation that was different in this case from any other case where the beneficiary of a contempt citation would have its lawyer prosecute the contempt.
I wouldn't be able to speculate. I would say that probably after this case gets published, every alleged contemnor's attorney will object. That'd be my advice.
What issue do you think is publishable in this case?
Well, it might get published someplace. If you don't publish it, I think word will get out that you better object if you want to have any any argument, I think. That's my position, if you want the position. But it doesn't distract from the argument that may appoint sometimes means shall appoint. And in this case, the argument is, if you look at the due process guarantees that are in Rule 107, to read, I think, may appears three times. And if you're going to read some of them to be shall and some of them to be, discretionary, that's inconsistent. And the example I used is, who would say that the court may impose a fine or jail if they find that the contemnor has committed contempt? Nobody would say that means they don't have to, and no judge would not do it. If you want to say, well, maybe it does mean that he doesn't have to, and maybe a court could find the contemnor in contempt and just not do anything about it, that's an unreasonable interpretation of the rule, and all rules construction go against giving an unreasonable interpretation of any rule or statute.
Okay, thank you.
How much time do I have left?
About 8.5 minutes.
Thank you.
Please, the court. My name is Robert Kendig. My number is 7527. The court's questions and Mr. Januszewski's argument are already notable for the fact that there has been no discussion of the facts supporting the court's finding of contempt in this case. The evidence was overwhelming that the defendant willfully violated an order of the district court. And what we're talking about are procedural issues. And while that's not insignificant, it is important because this is a contempt. Many cases cited in both briefs hold that there is no a specific fixed procedural formula for contempt cases, that due process is satisfied provided that the defendant has notice of the order and of the nature of the hearing. And the evidence is clear in this case that occurred. I will try to address the court's questions first, the areas the court has already asked questions about, as perhaps those are the most significant. The first is the question of the bond. The court's already asked about the Kaiser case, and I would argue that the Kaiser case, first of all, is factually limited to a nominal bond. The holding of the court was, we conclude that an injunction, including a TRO, is not void or invalid for failure to post a bond. But perhaps more important than that, this case does not involve the failure to post a bond. It's undisputed that a bond was posted. It's undisputed that it was a cash bond, and that Rule 121 says that a cash bond is effective immediately upon posting. So the issue is not whether a bond was ordered or whether a bond was posted or whether the bond was effective. The issue was the technicality of Rule 5 notice. There was no question that there was notice, but Rule 5 wasn't satisfied. Now, one of the reasons I made a request for oral argument was because of additional case law cited by the defendant's reply brief relating to bonds, cases from other jurisdictions, and I think it's the Stull case from Colorado. There is no question that in this state and other states that if a court enters a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction and does not make a provision for a bond, that injunction is not effective. That was the holding of all of the cases from other states cited by the defendant. There are Colorado cases to that effect. We don't have to go to other states. The issue here is not whether the court ordered the bond, because the court did order a bond. The issue isn't whether a bond was posted, because a bond was posted. So none of the cases cited by the defendant are any support for a reversal in this case. And in fact, the only authority even coming close to the factual situation we have here is the Kaiser case from Colorado and the federal cases that it relied on, which all hold universally that if a bond is ordered, the fact that it has not yet been posted, not the facts here, does not mean that the defendant or the subject of the contempt order cannot be held in contempt. So that is our position on the bond order. The other questions asked by the court concerning this matter are the questions related to who should be the prosecutor. And I think that's adequately argued in the briefs. There is no federal rule that a district attorney or private counsel must be appointed. Rule 107 is absolutely clear that it is discretionary. The Eichhorn case, cited by both sides, states that Rule 107 makes the appointment of alternate counsel or a special prosecutor, whatever.
Mr. Kendig, in the Eichhorn case, the Supreme Court had granted cert, and then apparently cert was denied as improvidently granted. Do you have any information more beyond that?
I have no information. And it was granted on that issue. I have no further information.
So it looked to me like the basis of your attorney's fees is the agreement that you had with the parties?
That's correct.
And if you didn't have that agreement, then you would be limited to the amount cited in the Chief Justice directive. Would that be?
Actually, I think if we didn't have that contract, we would not be entitled to fees at all.
At all. So we would just be the special prosecutor.
That's correct. I think that I suppose if a special prosecutor had been appointed, then the special prosecutor could have applied to the state for fees under the Chief Justice directive. But as private counsel, I don't believe I would be entitled to any fees from the defendant but for the contract.
And does it make any difference how specific the agreement has to be on attorney's fees at this level?
Well, I think only as a matter of contractual construction, but there was never any dispute that it covered this situation. The only issue was whether the agreement could be enforced in the context of a punitive contempt, which our position has always been and still is, was directly the holding of the Sanchez v. Hill case. And in fact, that actually was, it was argued in one of the briefs that Sanchez v. Hill did not so hold, but in the very first paragraph of the opinion in Sanchez v. Hill, the court said, the issue on appeal is whether a party who successfully seeks punitive sanctions against another in a criminal contempt proceeding is entitled to attorney fees under a contractual provision for such fees. And there is a direct contractual provision in this case of which the district court took judicial notice from prior proceedings, indicating that in actions to enforce the agreement, that fees would be awarded to the prevailing party.
Is it enough under Sanchez v. Hill that you have a contractual agreement, or do you also have to show future continuing harm that would be prevented?
That's an interesting question. The Sanchez v. Hill case discusses that issue as justification. I don't think it's required to show that you are mitigating future harm. I think it is enough to show that you have a contractual provision that entitles you to it. I think that the discussion in that case is surplusage. It just went on to explain why, in that case, the court found that the wife's attorney was the prevailing party. And I think the applicable rule in these contract fee shifting cases is that the finding of who is the prevailing party is a matter of the court's discretion. The court's discretion in that case was exercised in favor of the wife's attorney because she was prevailing on that issue. She was mitigating future harm. I think the holding is that if a sanction is imposed on the other party, I believe I cited the Dennis I. Spencer case and perhaps some others in my brief, that the court is within its discretion to find that the party in favor of whom the sanction is entered is the prevailing party. So I think it's just a question of how prevailing is interpreted.
Mr. Kendig, with regard to the amount of the attorney's fees that was awarded, would you agree that it was somewhat high in this case?
I would say it's extremely high. I would totally agree it's extremely high. And I would also say, and I tried to explain why in the brief, that it was well justified. It was an extremely high award. However, the amount was not contested in terms of, other than the fact that the argument has been made only now on appeal, that we're limited by the Chief Justice directive. But the amount of fees was extremely high, but given that we had the number of pretrial hearings that we had, the contempt hearing itself being continued three times, the defendant and his co-conspirators submitting hundreds of pages of falsified documents in discovery, at least twice, and Judge Boyd actually made a finding in the contempt order that the truth was not ultimately determined until almost the eve of the contempt hearing. It was an exceptionally difficult case. And I would say also, and I think this is related, that the difficulty of this case is, on a slightly different topic, another reason why the appointment of, or the use of counsel for the beneficiary as the prosecuting attorney in these cases is a sensible procedure. It would have been extremely difficult. It was difficult already. It would have been extremely difficult for an attorney outside of this case to come in cold and try to discover what it took us ultimately 10 months to discover.
So I gather you're suggesting that if there had been outside counsel prosecuting the contempt, he or she might have spent even more hours than you did.
Very likely. And maybe without effect. And in fact, on that same subject, I would say that family law cases, which this is not, enforcement in those cases would grind to an immediate halt in this state if a blanket rule were imposed that the counsel for the beneficiary of an order could not prosecute a contempt. So I think that this is a very significant issue in that regard. I believe just on the issue of the pleadings, which have not been addressed, one of the reasons that I requested oral argument was that a case called Wyatt versus the People was addressed in counsel's reply brief for the first time. The cases cited by the appellant for the proposition that the initial pleadings, contempt pleadings in this case, were inadequate are principally Wyatt versus the People and Fort versus the People. And in each of those cases, the pleadings on their face demonstrated that a contemptuous act had not occurred. In the Wyatt case, it was fascinating. The argument was that the particular person who was a public servant in charge of a public building in the state of Colorado would not allow a grand jury to go in and investigate something in that building. But there was no court order that required him to do so, and therefore no court order which he could violate. The Fort case was similar. I think that the Wyatt case has been cited a number of times since then, and one of the cases in which it was cited was the Girard versus Nevada Canal, which in turn was cited in the Roberts case. And I believe that those cases give the proper standard for pleadings in a contempt matter, which is simply that the evidentiary facts do not have to be stated in detail. Ultimate facts or generally conclusory allegations can be made in those pleadings, and that the evidence can be put on later. The question is really one of notice, and in this case, the verified motion for citation for contempt recited the precise language of the order that it was alleged the defendant violated, and it was stated that the defendant violated it in two or three ways. And I've made the arguments about the specificity of that in my brief. Because the defendant objected, the district judge ordered that it be made more specific. That was done, similar to a criminal information that can be made more specific by amendment. So unless your honors have other questions, I appreciate the opportunity to argue this.
May it please the court, counsel, the district court's decision must be reversed because the district court did not acquire jurisdiction of this contempt proceeding. This court need not address the other interesting issues if it holds, as it should, that the district court's actions from issuing the citation to sentencing Seabald to jail to awarding attorney's fees were a nullity, void for lack of jurisdiction. Lack of jurisdiction of the contempt proceedings is grounds for a federal habeas action. Just to the pleadings as counsel brought up in his argument. A verified motion must be signed by the movement and state that the facts contained in the motion are true. Here, the movement is an artificial entity, the plaintiff, Bishop Plumbing and Heating, Inc. The movement filed a purported verified motion for issuance of a contempt citation. The movement did not sign that verified motion. It was not a verified motion. And it did not present any facts, let alone facts sufficient to show that the contempt had been committed. Now, we talk about the verified motion appears at volume one, pages 173, 174. It's signed by Fred somebody. And Fred somebody is not identified. And Fred somebody's signature is not a corporate signature. It's not Fred, I think it's Ferrario. I had to pronounce it Fred as president of Bishop. It's not that kind of thing. It's just Fred Ferrario. It doesn't say who he is, how he knows these facts that he's alleging. Now, we all know that 107, Rule 107 says you initiate a contempt with a motion, affidavit, and you give them a proposed contempt citation you want the judge to issue. Now, the affidavit motion requirement has been consolidated. We will accept a verified motion. But the verified motion still has to perform the function of an affidavit. One of the first requirements of an affidavit is that it identify the affiant. I am the affiant. I am so-and-so, and I am, this is how I know this information about this case. We don't know who Fred Ferrario is from the record. It doesn't say who he is, especially on the verified motion for issuance of a contempt citation, which is where it should be identified. And counsel mentioned that there was an amended motion that cured the defect that even the trial judge pointed out. He said, well, you don't make any allegations that he committed the prohibitive acts in the area. And Seabald's trial counsel asked that it be dismissed. They start over again because of that. The court considered that, said, no, I'll just let him do an amended motion. That amended motion is also verified by Fred Ferrario. Also verified by him, but he's still not identified. We don't know who he is, and it didn't say who he was in either of the verified motions.
Mr. Januszewski?
Yes.
Did Mr. Seabald's trial counsel object to the original or the amended motions for the issuance of a contempt citation on the basis that that signature by Fred Ferrario or Ferrero, whatever it was insufficient?
Your Honor, just goes to the jurisdiction of the court, and he didn't need to. We raised jurisdiction in our opening brief, and the jurisdiction in our opening brief was based on the judges pointing out that the first motion was insufficient, and that letting them cure it with an amended motion didn't work. And then we added to that that the purported verified motion wasn't even a verified motion. Now, these are jurisdictional matters. Right? We even cite a case that reversed because a verified motion wasn't filed. Now, the objection that Droner suggests was not required. It is a jurisdictional matter. We brought it up here, and because it goes back to the very beginning, does not matter.
So I gather that your answer to my question is no.
No, he did not. Well, he did object. He said, there's an insufficient allegation here because you don't say he committed the act within, and the judge said, you're right. I'm going to let him fix that. He was focusing on notice, not jurisdiction. Now, we address in the reply brief the categorical difference between jurisdiction and notice. A trial judge cannot just willy-nilly, blindly issue a contempt citation on any papers put in front of him. He has an obligation to make a decision based on the initiating papers to see if there really is grounds for issuing a contempt citation. It's not just a matter of giving the alleged contemptor notice. There's a difference between jurisdiction and notice. Up until the appeal, all the attorneys in the trial court and the trial court itself were talking about notice. And there is a tendency in contemporary law to think, well, all there is notice. There's no such thing as jurisdiction. But Rule 107 itself says that the court shall review the paper, and if it appears as though contempt has been committed, it will issue a citation. The court can't just ignore its obligation to review the papers. If the papers are insufficient, the court has no jurisdiction, should not be issuing a contempt citation. Thank you. Still have time. Any questions?
Thank you. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.